or think you can't, you're right. Around the time Marty Seligman and Steve Mayer were linking hopelessness to a lack of perceived control, a young psychology major named Carol Dweck was making her way through college. Carol had always been intrigued that some people persevere, while others in identical circumstances give up. Right after graduation, she enrolled in a doctoral program in psychology and pursued this question. Marty and Steve's work had a profound influence on young Carol. She believed their findings, but was unsatisfied. Sure, attributing your misery to causes beyond your control was debilitating, but where did these attributions come from in the first place? Why, she asked, did one person grow up to be an optimist and another a pessimist? In one of Carol's first studies, she worked with middle schools to identify boys and girls who, by consensus of their teachers, the school principal, and the school psychologist, were especially helpless when confronted by failure. Her hunch was that these children believed that a lack of intellectual ability led to mistakes, rather than a lack of effort. In other words, she suspected it wasn't just a long string of failures that made these children pessimistic, but rather their core beliefs about success and learning. To test her idea, Carol divided the children into two groups. Half the children were assigned to a success-only program. For several weeks, they solved math problems, and at the end of each session, no matter how many they'd completed, they received praise for doing well. The other half of the children in Carol's study were assigned to an attribution retraining program. These children also solved math problems, but were occasionally told that they hadn't solved enough problems during that particular session, and crucially, that they should have tried harder. Afterward, all the children were given a combination of easy and very difficult problems to do. Carol reasoned that if prior failures were the root cause of helplessness, the success-only program would boost motivation. If, on the other hand, the real problem was how children interpreted their failures, then the attribution retraining program would be more effective. What Carol found is that the children in the success-only program gave up just as easily after encountering very difficult problems as they had before training. In sharp contrast, children in the attribution retraining program tried harder after encountering difficulty. It seems as though they'd learned to interpret failure as a cue to try harder, rather than as confirmation that they lacked the ability to succeed. Over the next four decades, Carol probed deeper. She soon discovered that people of all ages carry around in their minds private theories about how the world works. These points of view are conscious in that if Carol asks you questions about them, you have a ready answer. But like the thoughts you work on when you go to a cognitive behavioral therapist, you may not be aware of them until you're asked. Here are four statements Carol uses to assess a person's theory of intelligence. Listen to them now and consider how much you agree or disagree with each. 1. Your intelligence is something very basic about you that you can't change very much. 2. You can learn new things, but you can't really change how intelligent you are. 3. No matter how much intelligence you have, you can always change it quite a bit. 4. You can always substantially change how intelligent you are. If you found yourself nodding affirmatively to the first two statements, but shaking your head in disagreement with the last two, then Carol would say you have more of a fixed mindset. If you had the opposite reaction, then Carol would say you tend toward a growth mindset. I like to think of a growth mindset this way. Some of us believe, deep down, that people really can change. These growth-oriented people assume that it's possible, for example, to get smarter if you're given the right opportunities and support, and if you try hard enough, and if you believe you can do it. Conversely, some people think you can learn skills, like how to ride a bike or do a sales pitch, but your capacity to learn skills, your talent, can't be trained. The problem with holding the latter fixed mindset view, and many people who consider themselves talented do, is that no road is without bumps. Eventually, you're gonna hit one. At that point, having a fixed mindset becomes a tremendous liability. This is when a C-, a rejection letter, a disappointing progress review at work, or any other setback can derail you. With a fixed mindset, you're likely to interpret these setbacks as evidence that, after all, you don't have the right stuff. You're not good enough. With a growth mindset, you believe you can learn to do better. Mindsets have been shown to make a difference in all the same life domains as optimism. For instance, if you have a growth mindset, you're more likely to do well in school, enjoy better emotional and physical health, and have stronger, more positive social relationships with other people. A few years ago, Carol and I asked more than 2,000 high school seniors to complete a growth mindset questionnaire. We found that students with a growth mindset are significantly grittier than students with a fixed mindset. What's more, grittier students earn higher report card grades and after graduation are more likely to enroll in and persist through college. I've since measured growth mindset and grit in both younger children and older adults, and in every sample, I've found that growth mindset and grit go together. When you ask Carol where our mindsets come from, she'll point to people's personal histories of success and failure and how the people around them, particularly those in a position of authority, have responded to these outcomes. Consider, for example, what people said to you when as a child you did something really well. Were you praised for your talent or were you praised for your effort? Either way, chances are you use the same language today when evaluating victories and defeats. Praising effort and learning over natural talent is an explicit target of teacher training in the KIPP schools. KIPP stands for the Knowledge is Power program, and it was started in 1994 by Mike Feinberg and Dave Levin, two gritty young Teach for America teachers. Today, KIPP schools serve 70,000 elementary, middle, and high school students across the country. The vast majority of KIPPsters, as they proudly refer to themselves, come from low-income families. Against the odds, almost all graduate from high school, and more than 80% go on to college. KIPP teachers get a little thesaurus during training. On one side, there are encouragements teachers often use with the best of intentions. On the other, there is language that subtly sends the message that life is about challenging yourself and learning to do what you couldn't do before. Let's go through some examples appropriate for people of any age. Whether you're a parent, manager, coach, or any other type of mentor, I suggest you observe your own language over the next few days, listening for the beliefs your words may be reinforcing in yourself and others. My first example is one that undermines growth mindset and grit, and my second promotes growth mindset and grit. You're a natural. I love that. You're a learner. I love that. Well, at least you tried. That didn't work. Let's talk about how you approached it and what might work better. Great job. You're so talented. Great job. What's one thing that could have been even better? This is hard. Don't feel bad if you can't do it. This is hard. Don't feel bad if you can't do it yet. Maybe this just isn't your strength. Don't worry. You have other things to contribute. I have high standards. I'm holding you to them because I know we can reach them together. Language is one way to cultivate hope, but modeling a growth mindset, demonstrating by our actions that we truly believe people can learn to learn, may be even more important. Author and activist James Baldwin once put it this way, "Children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them." This is one of Dave Levin's favorite quotes, and I've watched him begin many KIPP training workshops with it. A psychologist in my lab, Daun Park, recently found this to be exactly the case. In a year-long study of first and second grade classrooms, she found that teachers who gave special privileges to higher performing students and emphasized how they compared to others inadvertently inculcated a fixed mindset among the young students. Over the year, students of teachers who acted this way grew to prefer games and problems that were easy, quote, so you can get a lot right, unquote. By year's end, they were more likely to agree that, quote, a person is a certain amount smart and stays pretty much the same, unquote. Similarly, Carol and her collaborators are finding that children develop more of a fixed mindset when their parents react to mistakes as though they're harmful and problematic. This is true even when these parents say they have a growth mindset. Our children are watching us, and they're imitating what we do. The same dynamics apply in a corporate setting. Berkeley professor Jennifer Chapman and her collaborators recently surveyed employees of Fortune 1000 companies about mindset, motivation, and well-being. They found that in each company, there was a consensus about mindset. In fixed mindset companies, employees agreed with statements like, when it comes to being successful, this company seems to believe that people have a certain amount of talent, and they really can't do much to change it. They felt that only a few star performers were highly valued, and that the company wasn't truly invested in other employees' development. These respondents also admitted to keeping secrets, cutting corners, and cheating to get ahead. By contrast, in growth mindset cultures, employees were 47% more likely to say their colleagues were trustworthy, 49% more likely to say their company fosters innovation, and 65% more likely to say their company supports risk-taking. How do you treat high achievers? How do you react when others disappoint you? My guess is that no matter how much you embrace the idea of growth mindset, you often default to a fixed mindset. At least, this is the case for Carol, Marty, and me. All of us know how we'd like to react when, say, someone we're supervising brings us work that falls short of expectations. We'd like our knee-jerk reflex to be calm and encouraging. We aspire to have an, okay, what is there to learn here attitude toward mistakes. But we're human. So more often than we'd like, we get frustrated. We show our impatience. In judging the person's abilities, we allow a flicker of doubt to distract us momentarily from the more important task of what they could do next to improve. The reality is that most people have an inner fixed mindset pessimist in them, right alongside their inner growth mindset optimist. Recognizing this is important because it's easy to make the mistake of changing what we say without changing our body language, facial expressions, and behavior. So, what should we do? A good first step is to watch for mismatches between our words and actions. When we slip up, and we will, we can simply acknowledge that it's hard to move away from a fixed, pessimistic view of the world. One of Carol's colleagues, Susan Mackey, works with CEOs and encourages them to give names to their inner fixed mindset characters. Then, they can say things like, oops, I guess I brought controlling Claire to the meeting today. Let me try that again. Or, overwhelmed Olivia is struggling to deal with all the competing demands. Can you help me think this through? Ultimately, adopting a gritty perspective involves recognizing that people get better at things. They grow. Just as we want to cultivate the ability to get up off the floor when life has knocked us down, we want to give those around us the benefit of the doubt when something they've tried isn't a raging success. There's always tomorrow. I recently called Bill McNabb for his perspective. Since 2008, Bill has served as the CEO of Vanguard, the world's largest provider of mutual funds. We've actually tracked senior leaders here at Vanguard, Bill told me, and asked why some did better in the long run than others. I used to use the word complacency to describe the ones who didn't work out, but the more I reflect on it, the more I realize that's not quite it. It's really a belief that I can't learn anymore. I am what I am. This is how I do things. And what about executives who ultimately excelled? I asked. The people who have continued to be successful here, Bill told me, have stayed on a growth trajectory. They just keep surprising you with how much they're growing. We've had people who, if you looked at their resume coming in, you'd say, wow, how did that person end up so successful? And we've had other people come in with incredible credentials, and you're wondering, why did they not go further? When Bill discovered the research on growth mindset and grit, it confirmed his intuitions, not just as a corporate leader, but as a father, former high school Latin teacher, rowing coach, and athlete. I really do think people develop theories about themselves and the world, he said, and it determines what they do. When we got to the question of where, exactly, any of us begin formulating these theories, Bill said, believe it or not, I actually started out with more of a fixed mindset. He chalks up that mindset partly to his parents enrolling him, while he was still in elementary school, in a research study at a nearby university. He remembers taking a whole battery of intelligence tests, and at the end being told, you did really well, and you're going to do really well in school. For a while, an authoritative diagnosis of talent, in combination with early success, boosted his confidence. I took great pride in finishing tests faster than anyone else, Bill told me. I didn't always get 100%, but I usually came close, and I took great pleasure in not working that hard to achieve what I did. Bill attributes his switch to a growth mindset to joining the crew team in college. I'd never rowed before, but I found I liked being on the water. I liked being outside. I liked the exercise. I sort of fell in love with the sport. Rowing was the first thing Bill wanted to do well that didn't come easily. I was not a natural, he told me. I had a lot of failures early on, but I kept going, and then eventually I started getting better. Suddenly, it began to make sense. Put your head down and go hard. Hard work really, really matters. By the end of his freshman season, Bill was in the junior varsity boat. That didn't sound so bad to me, but Bill explained that statistically, this placement suggested there was no chance of ever making varsity. That summer, he stayed on campus and rowed all summer. All that practice paid off. Bill was promoted to the stroke seat of the junior varsity boat, making him the one who sets the pace for the other seven rowers. During the season, one of the varsity rowers was injured, and Bill had the opportunity to show what he could do. By his account, and also the team captain's, he did terrifically well. Still, when the injured rower recovered, the coach demoted Bill again. That coach had a fixed mindset. He just couldn't believe that I'd improved as much as I did. There were more ups and downs, but Bill's growth mindset kept getting affirmed. Because I'd come so damn close to quitting and yet hung in there, and because things eventually did work out, I learned a lesson I'd never forget. The lesson was that when you have setbacks and failures, you can't overreact to them. You need to step back, analyze them, and learn from them. But you also need to stay optimistic. How did that lesson help Bill later in life? There have been times in my career where I felt discouraged, he told me. I'd watch someone else get promoted before me. I'd want things to go a certain way, and they'd go the opposite. At those points, I'd say to myself, just keep working hard and learning, and it will all work out. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger, Nietzsche once said. Kanye West and Kelly Clarkson echo the same sentiment, and there's a reason we keep repeating it. Many of us can remember a time when, like Bill McNabb, we were confronted with challenge, and yet emerged on the other side more confident than when we began. Consider, for example, the Outward Bound program, which sends adolescents or adults into the wilderness with experienced leaders, usually for a few weeks. From its inception a half century ago, the premise of Outward Bound, so named for the moment a ship leaves harbor for the open seas, has been that challenging outdoor situations develop tenacity in pursuit and undefeatable spirit. In fact, across dozens of studies, The program has been shown to increase independence, confidence, assertiveness, and the belief that what happens in life is largely under your control. What's more, these benefits tend to increase rather than diminish in the 6 months following participation in the program. All the same, it's undeniable that what doesn't kill us sometimes makes us weaker. Consider the dogs who are shocked repeatedly with no control. A third of the dogs were resilient to this adversity, but there was no evidence that any of the dogs in the uncontrollable stress condition benefited from the experience in any way. On the contrary, most were much more vulnerable to suffering in the immediate aftermath. So, it appears that sometimes what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and sometimes it does the opposite. The urgent question becomes, when? When does struggle lead to hope? And when does struggle lead to hopelessness? A few years ago, Steve Mayer and his students designed an experiment nearly identical to the one he and Marty Seligman had conducted 40 years earlier. One group of rats received electric shocks, but if they turned a small wheel with their front paws, they could turn off the shock until the next trial. A second group received the same dose of electric shocks as the first, but had no control over their duration. One crucial difference was that in the new experiment, the rats were only 5 weeks old. That's adolescence in the rat life cycle. A second difference was that the effects of this experience were assessed 5 weeks later, when the rats were fully mature adults. At that point, both groups of rats were subjected to uncontrollable electric shocks, and the next day observed in a social exploration test. Here's what Steve learned. Adolescent rats who experienced stress they could not control grew up to be adult rats who, after being subjected to uncontrollable shocks a second time, behaved timidly. This was not unusual. They learned to be helpless in the same way that any other rat would. In contrast, adolescent rats who experienced stress they could control grew up to be more adventurous and, most astounding, appeared to be inoculated against learned helplessness in adulthood. That's right. When these resilient rats grew up, the usual uncontrollable shock procedures no longer made them helpless. In other words, what didn't kill the young rats, when by their own efforts they could control what was happening, made them stronger for life. When I learned about Steve Mayer's new experimental work, I just had to talk to him in person. I got on a plane to Colorado. Steve walked me around his laboratory and showed me the special cages equipped with little wheels that, when turned, cut off the current to the electric shock. Afterward, the graduate student who ran the experiment on adolescent rats that I just described gave a talk on the brain circuits and neurotransmitters involved. Finally, when Steve and I sat down together, I asked him to explain, from this experiment and everything else he'd done in his long and distinguished career, the neurobiology of hope. Steve thought for a moment. Here's the deal in a few sentences. You've got lots of places in the brain that respond to aversive experiences, like the amygdala. In fact, there are a whole bunch of limbic areas that respond to stress. I nodded. Now, what happens is that these limbic structures are regulated by higher-order brain areas, like the prefrontal cortex. And so, if you have an appraisal, a thought, a belief, whatever you want to call it, that says, wait a minute, I can do something about this, or this really isn't so bad, or whatever, then these inhibitory structures in the cortex are activated. They send a message, cool it down there, don't get so activated, there's something we can do. I got it, but I still didn't understand fully why Steve had gone to the trouble of experimenting with adolescent rats. The long-term story needs some more explanation, he continued. We think there is plasticity in that circuitry. If you experience adversity, something pretty potent that you overcome on your own during your youth, you develop a different way of dealing with adversity later on. It's important that the adversity be pretty potent, because these brain areas really have to wire together in some fashion, and that doesn't happen with just minor inconveniences. So you can't just talk someone into believing they can master challenges, I asked. That's right. Just telling somebody they can overcome adversity isn't enough. For the rewiring to happen, you have to activate the control circuitry at the same time as those low-level inhibitory areas. That happens when you experience mastery at the same time as adversity. And what about a life history of challenge without control? I worry a lot about kids in poverty, Steve said. They're getting a lot of helplessness experiences. They're not getting enough mastery experiences. They're not learning, I can do this, I can succeed in that. My speculation is that these early experiences can have really enduring effects. You need to learn that there's a contingency between your actions and what happens to you. If I do something, then something will happen. The scientific research is very clear that experiencing trauma without control can be debilitating. But I also worry about people who cruise through life friction-free for a long, long time before encountering their first real failure. They have so little practice falling and getting up again. They have so many reasons to stick with a fixed mindset. I see a lot of invisibly vulnerable high achievers stumble in young adulthood and struggle to get up again. I call them the fragile perfects. Sometimes I meet fragile perfects in my office after a midterm or a final. Very quickly, it becomes clear that these bright and wonderful people know how to succeed, but not how to fail. Last year, I kept in touch with a freshman at Penn named Kayvon Asamani. Kayvon has the sort of resume that might make you worry he's a fragile perfect. Valedictorian of his high school class, student body president, star athlete, the list goes on. But I assure you that Kayvon is the very embodiment of growth mindset and optimism. We met when he was a senior at the Milton Hershey School, a tuition-free boarding school originally established by chocolatier Milton Hershey for orphan boys, and to this day, a haven for children from severely disadvantaged backgrounds. Kayvon and his siblings ended up at Hershey just before Kayvon entered the fifth grade, 1 year after his father nearly strangled his mother to death, leaving her in a permanent coma. At Hershey, Kayvon thrived. He discovered a passion for music, playing the trombone in two school bands, and he discovered leadership, giving speeches to state politicians, creating a student-run school news website, chairing committees that raised tens of thousands of dollars for charity, and, in his senior year, serving as student body president. In January, Kayvon emailed to let me know how his first semester had gone. I finished the first semester with a 3.5, he wrote, 3 A's and 1 C. I'm not completely satisfied with it. I know what I did right to get the A's, and I know what I did wrong to get the C. As for his poorest grade, that C in economics caught up to me because I was in a hole from my conflicted thoughts about this place and whether I fit in. I can definitely do better than a 3.5, and a 4.0 is not out of the question. My first semester mentality was that I have a lot to learn from these kids. My new mentality is that I have a lot to teach them. The spring semester wasn't exactly smooth sailing either. Kayvon earned a bunch of A's, but didn't do nearly as well as he'd hoped in his two quantitative courses. We talked briefly about the option of transferring out of Wharton, Penn's highly competitive business school, and I pointed out that there was no shame in switching into a different major. Kayvon was having none of it. Here's an excerpt from his email to me in June. Numbers and executing quantitative concepts have always been difficult for me, but I embrace the challenge, and I'm going to apply all the grit I have to improving myself and making myself better, even if it means graduating with a GPA less than what I would have earned if I just majored in something that didn't require me to manipulate numbers. I have no doubt that Kayvon will keep getting up, time and again, always learning and growing. Collectively, the evidence I've presented tells this story. A fixed mindset about ability leads to pessimistic explanations of adversity. And that, in turn, leads to both giving up on challenges and avoiding them in the first place. In contrast, a growth mindset leads to optimistic ways of explaining adversity. And that, in turn, leads to perseverance and seeking out new challenges that will ultimately make you even stronger. My recommendation for teaching yourself hope is to take each step in this sequence of three phrases. Growth mindset leads to optimistic self-talk, leads to perseverance over adversity. And ask yourself, what can I do to boost this one? My first suggestion in that regard is to update your beliefs about intelligence and talent. When Carol and her collaborators try to convince people that intelligence or any other talent can improve with effort, she starts by explaining the brain. For instance, she recounts a study published in the top scientific journal, Nature, that tracked adolescent brain development. Many of the adolescents in this study increased their IQ scores from age 14, when the study started, to age 18, when it concluded. This fact, that IQ scores are not entirely fixed over a person's lifespan, usually comes as a surprise. What's more, Carol continues, these same adolescents showed sizable changes in brain structure. Those who got better at math skills strengthened the areas of the brain related to math, and the same was true for English skills. Carol also explains that the brain is remarkably adaptive. Like a muscle that gets stronger with use, the brain changes itself when you struggle to master a new challenge. In fact, there's never a time in life when the brain is completely fixed. Instead, all of our lives, our neurons retain the potential to grow new connections with one another and to strengthen the ones we already have. What's more, throughout adulthood, we maintain the ability to grow myelin, a sort of insulating sheath that protects neurons and speeds signals traveling between them. My next suggestion is to practice optimistic self-talk. The link between cognitive behavioral therapy and learned helplessness led to the development of resilience training. In essence, this interactive curriculum is a preventative dose of cognitive behavioral therapy. In one study, children who completed this training showed lower levels of pessimism and developed fewer symptoms of depression over the next 2 years. In a similar study, pessimistic college students demonstrated less anxiety over the subsequent 2 years and less depression over 3 years. If, listening to this chapter, you recognize yourself as an extreme pessimist, my advice is to find a cognitive behavioral therapist. I know how unsatisfying this recommendation might sound. Many years ago, as a teenager, I wrote to Dear Abby about a problem I was having. "Go see a therapist," she wrote back. I recall tearing up her letter, angry she didn't propose a neater, faster, more straightforward solution. Nevertheless, suggesting that reading 20 pages about the signs of hope is enough to remove an ingrained pessimistic bias would be naive. There's much more to say about cognitive behavioral therapy and resilience training than I can summarize here. The point is that you can in fact modify your self-talk, and you can learn to not let it interfere with you moving toward your goals. With practice and guidance, you can change the way you think, feel, and most important, act when the going gets rough. As a transition to the final section of this book, Growing Grit from the Outside In, let me offer one final suggestion for teaching yourself hope. Ask for a helping hand. A few years ago, I met a retired mathematician named Rhonda Hughes. Nobody in Rhonda's family had gone to college, but as a girl, she liked math a whole lot more than stenography. Rhonda eventually earned a PhD in mathematics, and after 79 of her 80 applications for a faculty position were rejected, she took a job at the single university that made her an offer. One reason Rhonda got in touch was to tell me that she had an issue with an item on the grit scale. I don't like that item that says, "Setbacks don't discourage me." That makes no sense. I mean, who doesn't get discouraged by setbacks? I certainly do. I think it should say, "Setbacks don't discourage me for long. I get back on my feet." Of course, Rhonda was right, and in so many words, I changed the item accordingly. But the most important thing about Rhonda's story is that she almost never got back up all by herself. Instead, she figured out that asking for help was a good way to hold on to hope. Here's just one of the stories she told me. I had this mentor who knew even before I did that I was going to be a mathematician. It all started when I'd done very poorly on one of his tests, and I went to his office and cried. All of a sudden, he jumped up out of his chair and without a word ran out of the room. When finally he came back, he said, "Young lady, you should go to graduate school in mathematics, but you're taking all the wrong courses." And he had all the courses I should have been taking mapped out, and the personal promises of other faculty that they'd help. About 20 years ago, Rhonda co-founded the EDGE program with Sylvia Bozeman, a fellow mathematician. EDGE stands for Enhancing Diversity in Graduate Education, and its mission is to support women and minority students pursuing doctoral training in mathematics. "People assume you have to have some special talent to do mathematics," Sylvia has said. "They think you're either born with it or you're not. But Rhonda and I keep saying, you actually develop the ability to do mathematics. Don't give up." There have been so many times in my career when I wanted to pack it in, when I wanted to give up and do something easier, Rhonda told me. But there was always someone who, in one way or another, told me to keep going. I think everyone needs somebody like that, don't you? Part 3, Growing Grit from the Outside In. Chapter 10, Parenting for Grit. What can I do to encourage grit in the people I care for? I'm asked this question at least once a day. Sometimes it's a coach who asks. Sometimes it's an entrepreneur or a CEO. Last week, it was a fourth grade teacher, and the week before, a math professor at a community college. I've had Army generals and Navy admirals toss me this question, too. But most often, it's a mother or father who worries that their child isn't close to realizing their potential. All the people quizzing me are thinking as parents would, of course, even if they're not parents. The word parenting derives from Latin and means to bring forth. You're acting in a parent-like way if you're asking for guidance on how to best bring forth interest, practice, purpose, and hope in the people you care for. When I turn the tables and ask people for their own intuitions about how to parent for grit, I get different answers. Some believe grit is forged in the crucible of adversity. Others are quick to paraphrase Nietzsche, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." When I hear that, I sometimes interrupt with a précis of Steve Mayer's research, showing that, in fact, finding a way out of the suffering is what does the strengthening. Such invocations conjure an image of scowling mothers and fathers dispensing endless criticism on the sidelines of games that had better be victories, or chaining their children to the piano bench or violin stand, or grounding them for the sin of an A-. This perspective assumes that offering loving support and demanding high standards are two ends of a continuum, with the authoritarian parents of the gritty far to the right of center. Had I been around to seek opinions a century ago, such would have been the perspective of John Watson, then chair of psychology at Johns Hopkins University. In his best-selling 1928 parenting guide, Psychological Care of Infant and Child, Watson holds forth on how to raise a child, quote, "who loses himself in work and play, who quickly learns to overcome the small difficulties in his environment, and who finally enters manhood so bulwarked with stable work and emotional habits that no adversity can quite overwhelm him," unquote. Here's Watson's advice. Never hug and kiss them. Never let them sit in your lap. If you must, kiss them once on the forehead when they say goodnight. Shake hands with them in the morning. Give them a pat on the head if they have made an extraordinarily good job of a difficult task. Watson further recommends letting children cope with problems on their own, almost from the moment of birth, rotating different caregivers to prevent unhealthy attachment to any one adult, and otherwise avoiding the coddling affection that prevents a child from, quote, conquering the world, unquote. Occasionally, of course, people take the opposite stance. They're convinced that perseverance and especially passion bloom when children are lavished with unconditional affection and support. These champions of kinder and gentler parenting advocate big hugs and long leashes and point out that children are by their nature challenge-seeking creatures whose innate desire for competence needs only our unconditional love and affection to reveal itself. Once unfettered by the demands of imperious parents, children will follow their own intrinsic interests, and disciplined practice and resilience in the face of setbacks will follow. On the continuum between supportive and demanding parenting, proponents of this permissive, child-centered approach fall to the left of center. So which is it? Is grit forged in the crucible of unrelentingly high standards, or is it nurtured in the warm embrace of loving support? As a scientist, I'm tempted to answer that we need more research on the topic. There's a lot of research on parenting and some research on grit, but no research yet on parenting and grit. But as a mother of two teenagers, I don't have time for all the data to come in. Like the parents asking me this question, I have to make decisions today. My girls are growing up, and each day of their lives, my husband and I are parenting them, for better or for worse. What's more, as a professor and a lab director, I interact with dozens of young people, and I'd like to encourage their grit, too. So, as a step toward resolving the debate, I've probed the evidence for each side. An advocate of old-fashioned, strict parenting suggested I talk to grit paragon Steve Young, the record-breaking quarterback whose Mormon upbringing included a daily paper route, Bible classes before school, and absolutely no cussing or drinking. Meanwhile, an advocate with a more liberal bent pointed me toward Francesca Martinez, the outspoken British stand-up comic whose writer father, an environmentalist mother, allowed her to drop out of school when she was 16 and didn't bat an eye when she titled her memoir, What the Blank is Normal. Let's begin with Steve Young. The legendary quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers was twice named Most Valuable Player in the National Football League, and he was selected Most Valuable Player of Super Bowl XXIX, during which he completed a record-breaking 6 touchdown passes. At retirement, he was the highest-rated quarterback in NFL history. "My parents were my foundation," Steve has said. "Good parenting is something I wish everyone could have." Here's a story to illustrate his point. Though Steve had been the star of his high school football team and was heavily recruited by colleges across the country, he entered Brigham Young University as their 8th-string quarterback. Since 7 other quarterbacks stood between Steve and playing time, his coach relegated him to the hamburger squad, a unit composed of the least valuable players, whose primary role was to run plays so the BYU defensive line could practice. "Man, I wanted to go home," Steve recalled. "I went to school my whole first semester with my bags packed. I remember calling my dad and just saying, 'Coaches don't know my name. I'm just a big tackling dummy for the defense. Dad, it's horrible, and this is just not what I expected, and I think I'd like to come home." Steve's father, whom Steve describes as the ultimate tough guy, told him, "You can quit, but you can't come home because I'm not going to live with a quitter. You've known that since you were a kid. You're not coming back here." Steve stayed. All season, Steve was first to practice and last to leave. After the team's last game, he stepped up his private workouts. "There was a huge net hanging at the far end of the fieldhouse," he said. "I squatted behind an imaginary center, took the snap, did the 3-step drop, and threw into the net. From the beginning of January to the end of February, I threw over 10,000 spirals. My arm hurt, but I wanted to be a quarterback." By sophomore year, Steve moved up from number 8 quarterback to number 2. By his junior year, he was BYU's starting quarterback. In his senior year, Steve received the Davey O'Brien Award for the most outstanding quarterback in the country. There were several other times in his athletic career when his confidence faltered. Each time, he wanted desperately to quit. Each time, he appealed to his father, who wouldn't let him. One early challenge came while playing baseball in middle school. "I was 13," Steve recalled. "I didn't get a hit the whole year, and it just got more and more embarrassing. Game after game, I couldn't get a hit." When the season ended, Steve informed his dad that he'd had it. "My dad looked me straight in the eye and said, 'You cannot quit. You have the ability, so you need to go back and work this out.'" So Steve and his dad went back to the field. "I remember it being really cold and miserable," Steve said, "and rainy and sleet and snow, and he'd be pitching the ball and I'd be hitting them." By his senior year in high school, as captain of the varsity baseball team, Steve was batting .384. The lesson that persistence eventually delivers rewards was one on which Steve relied in the 4 years he sat on the bench with the San Francisco 49ers. Rather than request a trade, Steve apprenticed himself to Joe Montana, the starting quarterback who captained the team to 4 Super Bowl victories. "If I was ever going to find out just how good I could get, I needed to stay in San Francisco and learn, even if it was brutally hard to do. I many times thought about quitting. I heard boos during my sleepless nights, but I feared calling my dad. I knew what he'd say. Endure to the end, Steve." At this point in my narrative of Steve Young's improbable ascent, you might conclude that parents of gritty children are authoritarian. You might leap to the conclusion that they're centered on their own standards and fairly insensitive to their children's particular needs. Before you issue a final verdict, though, sit down with Steve's parents, Sherry and LeGrand Young. And before you do, note that LeGrand prefers the childhood nickname that aptly captures his approach to life, Grit. "He's all about hard work and being tough and not whining," Steve's brother Mike once said of his father. The name really fits him. As a corporate attorney, Grit Young seldom missed a day of work. About 25 years ago, Grit was working out at his local YMCA when a fellow gym-goer challenged him to an ongoing sit-up competition. After a year, each man could do about 1,000 sit-ups each, at which point the challenger bowed out. By then, Grit was competing against himself. He kept on for years until he could do 10,000 sit-ups in a row. When I called to talk to Steve's parents about their famous son and the way they'd raised him, I expected sternness and formality. The first thing Sherry said was, "We're delighted to talk to you. Our Steve is a great kid." Grit then joked that, given my chosen field of study, he was surprised it had taken me so long to get to them. My shoulders softened a bit, and I sat back as each told me how they'd learned to work hard early in life. "We were one generation off the farm," Sherry explained. "There were expectations." Sherry was picking cherries by age 10. Grit did the same, and to earn money for baseball mitts and clothes, he mowed lawns, delivered newspapers on his bike to houses miles apart, and picked up whatever farm work he could. When it came time to raise their children, both Sherry and Grit very deliberately set out to provide the same challenges. "My goal was to teach them discipline," Grit said, "and to go at things hard, like I learned to do. You have to learn those things. They don't just happen. It was important to me to teach the kids to finish what you begin." In no uncertain terms, Steve and his siblings were made to understand that whatever they signed up for, they had to see it through to the end. "We told them, you've got to go to all the practices. You can't say, 'Oh, I'm tired of this.' Once you commit, you discipline yourself to do it. There's going to be times you don't want to go, but you've got to go." Sounds strict, right? It was. But if you listen closely, you'll discover that the Youngs were also tremendously supportive. Steve tells the story of getting tackled playing Pop Warner football as a 9-year-old and looking up to see his mom still carrying her purse striding right past him to grab a boy on the opposing team by the shoulder pads to tell him that he would not be illegally neck-tackling Steve again. As Steve and his siblings got older, their home became a favorite hangout. "Our basement was always filled with kids," Sherry says. As a corporate attorney, Grit traveled often. "Most guys I knew would stay for the weekend, wherever we were, because you wouldn't be finished with your business on Friday, and you had to start again on Monday. Not me. I always, always did everything I could to get home for the weekend." Occasionally, weekend trips home were also demonstrations of the character that had earned Grit his nickname. "Once I was in Montana," Grit told me, "negotiating with an aluminum plant. Friday night, I take a taxi down to the airport, and it's all fogged in. All the flights were canceled." I considered what I might do in the same situation, and then blushed a bit as I listened to the rest of the story. Grit rented a car, drove to Spokane, took a flight to Seattle, then a second flight to San Francisco, and finally a third flight, a red-eye that arrived at JFK the next morning at dawn. He then got in another rental car and drove back to Greenwich, Connecticut. "I'm not patting myself on the back," Grit said. "It's just that I thought it was important to be with the kids, to support them, whether it was athletic activities or anything else." Sherry and Grit were also attuned to their children's emotional needs. Steve, for example, was especially anxious. "We noticed there were things he wouldn't do," Grit said. "When he was in second grade, he refused to go to school. When he was 12, he wouldn't go to Boy Scout camp. He never slept over at another kid's house. He just wouldn't do it." It was hard for me to square the image of Steve Young, fearless all-star quarterback, with the timid boy Sherry and Grit were describing. Likewise, neither Sherry nor Grit had any idea what to make of their oldest son's fearfulness. One time, Grit says, he went to pick up Steve from school to take him to his uncle and aunt's house for the day, and Steve simply couldn't stop sobbing. He was petrified to be away from his own home. Grit was flabbergasted. I waited to hear how he and Sherry reacted. Did they tell their son to man up? Did they remove some of his privileges? No and no. Grit's description of the talk he had with his son when Steve refused to go to school makes it clear Grit did more questioning and listening than lecturing and criticizing. "I said, well, is somebody picking on you?" He says, "No." "Do you like your teacher?" "I love my teacher." "Well, why don't you go to school?" "I don't know. I just don't want to go to school." Sherry ended up sitting in Steve's second grade classroom for weeks until at long last, Steve felt comfortable going to school by himself. "It was separation anxiety," Sherry told me. "At the time, we didn't know what to call it, but we could tell he was all tight inside, and we knew that he needed to work through all that." Later, when I asked Steve to elaborate on his first troubled semester at BYU, I pointed out that if someone heard only that anecdote and nothing else, they might conclude that his father, Grit, was a tyrant. What kind of parent could refuse a son his plea to return home? "Okay," Steve said, "all right. Everything is contextual, right?" I listened. "The context was that my dad knew me. He knew all I wanted to do was sprint home, and he knew that if he let me do that, it would be letting me give in to my fears. It was a loving act," Steve concluded. "It was tough, but it was loving." "But it's a fine line between tough love and bullying, isn't it? What's the difference?" I wondered. "I knew the decision was mine," Steve said, "and I knew my dad didn't want me to be him. Number one, a parent needs to set a stage that proves to the child, I'm not trying to just have you do what I say, control you, make you be like me, make you do what I did, ask you to make up for what I didn't do. My dad showed me early that it wasn't about him and what he needed. It truly was, I'm giving you all I got." There was an underlying selflessness to the tough love, Steve continued. "I think that's vital. If any of the tough love is about the parent just trying to control you, well, kids smell it out. In every way possible, I knew my parents were saying, we're looking to see your success. We've left ourselves behind." If getting to know the Youngs helps you understand, that tough love isn't necessarily a contradiction in terms, hold that thought, and meet Francesca Martinez and her parents, Tina and Alex. Named by the Observer newspaper as one of the funniest comics in Britain, Francesca performs to sold-out audiences around the world. In a typical routine, she breaks the no-cussing rule of the Young family, and after the show, she's sure to violate the drinking prohibition. Like her parents, Francesca is a lifelong vegetarian, not religious, and politically somewhere to the left of progressive. Francesca was diagnosed with cerebral palsy at age 2. She prefers the term wobbly. Told that their brain-damaged daughter would never lead a normal life, Tina and Alex quickly decided that no doctor could foretell who their daughter might become. Achieving comedic stardom takes grit, no matter who you are, but perhaps more so when it's a challenge merely to enunciate your consonants or walk to the stage. So, like other aspiring comics, Francesca has endured 4-hour drives each way to perform for 10 minutes for no pay, and made countless cold calls to impassive and busy television producers. But unlike most of her peers, she needs to do breathing and voice exercises before each show. "I don't take credit for my hard work and passion," she told me. "I think these qualities came from my family, which was very loving and very stable. Their overwhelming support and positivity are why there is no limit to my ambition." Not surprisingly, counselors at Francesca's school were doubtful of entertainment as a career path for a girl who struggled to walk and talk at a normal cadence. They were even more wary of her dropping out of high school to do so. "Oh, Francesca," they'd say with a sigh, "think about something more sensible, like computers." The thought of an office job was about as horrible a fate as Francesca could imagine. She asked her parents what she should do. "Go and follow your dreams," Alex told his daughter, "and if they don't work out, then you can reassess." "My mom was just as encouraging," Francesca said. Then, with a smile, "basically, they were happy for me to leave formal education at 16 to act on television. They let me spend my weekends clubbing with friends, surrounded by leery men and cocktails with sexually explicit names." I asked Alex about his follow your dream advice. Before explaining, he reminded me that Francesca's brother Raul was also allowed to drop out of high school to apprentice himself to a renowned portrait painter. "We never put pressure on either of them to become doctors or lawyers or anything like that," Alex told me. "I truly believe that when you do something you really want to do, it becomes a vocation. Francesca and her brother are incredibly hard workers, but they feel passionately about their subjects, so to them it's not at all oppressive." Tina agreed entirely. "I've always had an instinctive sense that life and nature and evolution have planted in children their own capabilities, their own destiny," she said. "Like a plant, if they're fed and watered in the right way, they will grow up beautiful and strong. It's just a question of creating the right environment, a soil that is nurturing, that is listening and responsive to their needs. Children carry within them the seeds of their own future. Their own interests will emerge if we trust them." Francesca connects the unconditional support that her absurdly cool parents, as she put it, lavished on her, to the hope she maintained even when hope seemed lost. "So much of sticking with things is believing you can do it," she told me. "That belief comes from self-worth, and that comes from how others have made us feel in our lives." So far, Alex and Tina seem the epitome of permissive parenting. I asked them whether they see themselves as such. "Actually," Alex said, "I think I'm allergic to spoiled children. Children must be loved and accepted, but then, without complications, they need to be taught, no, you cannot hit your sister on the head with that stick. Yes, you must share. No, you don't get to have everything you want when you want it. It's no-nonsense parenting." As an example, Alex pushed Francesca to do the physical therapy exercises prescribed by her doctors. She hated them. For years, she and her father battled. Francesca couldn't understand why she couldn't simply work around her limitations, and Alex believed his responsibility was to stand firm. As she says in her book, "Though happy in many ways, the next few years were punctuated with intense rows, complete with door banging and tears and the throwing of objects. Whether these skirmishes could have been handled more skillfully is an open question. Alex believes he could have done a better job explaining to his young daughter why he was so insistent. That may be so,